What I thought I'd do today, last May, our Deputy Secretary, Robert Kimmett, spoke to the Institute about a Treasury transformed. And what I thought I would do today is, number one, provide a little further detail on Treasury's Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, what we call TFI. And then I'd like to give you a sense of our strategic approach for combating terrorist financing and some of the challenges that we face in that effort. And then secondly, I wanted to give you a brief update since Deputy Secretary Kimmett's visit on what we've been doing with respect to Iran, with respect to its proliferation activities, support for terror, and its threat to the integrity of the international financial system. So I'll start with a few words about TFI. And in the broadest sense, TFI really has a threefold mission: to safeguard the financial system from criminal and illicit activity, to produce financial analysis and information through the BSA, the Bank Secrecy Act, to assist law enforcement in counterterrorism and other authorities, and to combat threats to our national security or foreign policy interests through targeted financial actions. To advance this mission, as Matt mentioned, TFI, led by Undersecretary Stuart Levy, relies primarily on the Office of Intelligence and Analysis, OIA, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, OFAC, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, and my office, the Office of Terrorist Financing and Financial Crimes. And I'll say maybe just a few words about each. With the establishment of OIA, Treasury became the only finance ministry in the world to have its own intelligence component. And this is vitally important because we routinely rely on the analysis from OIA to identify and take targeted economic or financial action against terrorist supporters and financiers and others who threaten our national security and seek to abuse our financial system. OIA analysis is the backbone supporting the designation of individuals or entities under our Terrorist Financing Authority, Executive Order 13224. But also importantly, OIA serves as Treasury's representative to the larger intelligence community, thus helping to shape and refine intelligence collection requirements and priorities. Now, a significant challenge for us moving forward is to work with allies around the world to establish some similar capabilities. Number one, to establish a mechanism for financial authorities to access intelligence, and number two, for them to develop some clear legal authorities to be able to use intelligence to inform the application of targeted financial measures. OFAC implements and administers our principal terrorist financing authority, Executive Order 13224. And most people know the immediate legal effect of those designations, the freezing of assets held by U.S. persons and the prohibition on U.S. persons from further unauthorized dealings with those parties. However, what might be less apparent is that designations can be valuable far beyond the simple amount of money that they freeze. In many cases, designations can also deter non-designated parties. It can expose terrorist financing money trails. It can impede terrorists' use of formal financial and commercial mechanisms and force them into less efficient and riskier means of doing their business. And they can also be the means for international cooperation and compliance under the UN frameworks, Security Council Resolutions 1267 and its successors, and Security Council Resolution 1373. Another challenge that we face in this area is once again encouraging our international partners to identify responsible agencies which are adequately resourced and dedicated to implementing effective targeted financial measures. Such a body would have to carry out basic functions of designations, compliance, enforcement, importantly licensing and delisting, and outreach to the private sector. Too often, we see that these functions, if they're done at all, are carried out by disparate agencies that are difficult to coordinate and not dedicated specifically to the task. Under the Bank Secrecy Act, FinCEN publishes regulations and guidance to improve financial transparency. And very broadly, these regulations require financial institutions to develop and implement customer identification, record keeping and reporting, anti-money laundering programs, and the filing of suspicious activity reports. Internationally, FinCEN, as the repository of our BSA data, serves as our financial intelligence unit and thus is the gateway for cooperation with other financial intelligence units, FIUs, through the Egmont Group as a means to cooperate on financial investigations. Going forward, we have to continue our efforts to work with our partners to establish effective FIUs, make them fully functional, and then use those resources to advance terrorist financing and other investigations. My office, the Office of Terrorist Financing and Financial Crimes, as Matt said, is the policy and outreach arm of TFI. We develop and implement policies and strategies, initiatives, to identify and address vulnerabilities, systemic vulnerabilities, in both the U.S. and international financial systems, and also policies to apply specifically the targeted financial tools that we've talked about. To do this, we work bilaterally with other countries. We also work multilaterally through organizations like the G7, through the international financial institutions, through the Financial Action Task Force, and the various FATF regional style bodies around the world. We also engage in extensive outreach domestically with the private, financial, and charitable sectors. Now, before I turn to some of Treasury's specific efforts to combat terrorist financing, I just want to emphasize at the outset that these efforts are truly interagency and that we do this as part of a team. I'll focus on Treasury's role, but our efforts are closely coordinated with other agencies. We are in close contact with our intelligence, law enforcement, diplomatic, military, and other agencies. We benefit from very strong relationships with our international our interagency partners, particularly through the National Security Council's Counterterrorism Security Group, its subgroup on terrorist financing, and the strategic planning efforts of the National Counterterrorism Center. I think you had Mike Leiter here maybe a couple of weeks ago talking about that. So turning now more specifically to terrorist financing itself, I think it's important to place it in a broader context. Quite simply, combating the financing of terrorism is part of the broader war on terror. The wider landscape of terrorist support includes those structures and organizations that terrorists rely upon to execute their attacks and advance their agendas. I think we've all heard arguments posed by those who question the effectiveness of counter-terrorist financing efforts. These critics often point to the minimal costs and relative ease of procuring materials that are often used in terrorist attacks, like precursor chemicals or suicide belts. However, as a number of people and some of the scholars in this room have pointed out, these arguments ignore the much larger and sustained expenses required to finance the terrorist life cycle, involving propaganda, radicalization, recruitment, and often popular support gained through the delivery of welfare and social services. An essential question driving our analysis is, where do terrorists get their funds? Experience tells us that terrorist organizations rely on three general sources of financing and support. Donors, particularly ideologically motivated individuals, but also funds raised through charities, from witting or unwitting individuals, criminal proceeds, and state sponsorship. Next, we're constantly examining the ways that such organizations move their funds. Terrorist organizations, like many criminal organizations, exploit three fundamental conduits of moving value. These conduits include the formal financial system, financial institutions, the physical movement of currency, cash, and the physical movements of goods through trade. Now, they employ a number of different mechanisms, including wire transfers, cash couriers, charities, and informal value transfer systems, which include alternative remittance systems like Hawala. Hawalas, in turn, can conduct transactions or settlements through any of the three ways of moving value, financial institutions, cash, or trade. Going forward, one of our challenges is we're studying how emerging payment systems, the internet, the emergence of other new technologies like cell phone systems, prepaid cards, and others might be exploited by terrorist organizations. now that we have a bit of the context of terrorist financing, you know, what is our game plan? What's our approach? TFI has adopted a comprehensive approach to combating these various sources and conduits of terrorist financing by, number one, developing, implementing, and wherever possible, globalizing measures to close down these systemic vulnerabilities. Number two, taking targeted actions. This requires being able to identify critical nodes of terrorist support, and then implementing, and once again globalizing, targeted actions and initiatives against those nodes. And then number three, enhancing both the implementation of systemic and targeted measures through outreach to the private sector. On the systemic side, TFI and its federal agency partners have made substantial efforts to mitigate some key vulnerabilities. For example, on charities, domestically, we've promoted greater transparency through stronger reporting requirements for charities that are seeking tax-exempt recognition. We have also worked closely with the charitable sector to develop Treasury's voluntary anti-terrorist financing guidelines for the sector. On the international front, we've helped develop an international standard to combat terrorist exploitation of charities. This standard has four basic pillars. Number one, the supervision and coordinated oversight of the charitable sector. Number two, regulatory and law enforcement investigation and action. Three, international engagement, because so many charities operate across borders. And finally, outreach to the private sector, ensuring that there is a dialogue between the government and the charitable sector. Charities remain a significant vulnerability, and we're working hard with the international community to find ways to support the genuine and heartfelt desire of people all over the world to support charitable and humanitarian causes while taking targeted action against the very small minority of charities that are exploited by terrorist organizations. Another key systemic vulnerability are cash couriers. We have seen as, over time, the formal financial system has become more rigorous in its customer identification and other procedures, a growing reliance on the use of cash and the use of bulk cash smuggling to move value. We have worked in collaboration with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to develop an international standard, once again, requiring cross-border declaration or disclosure of currency. ICE has also been very active in training and assisting jurisdictions on effective bulk cash investigations and enforcement operations. I would note that this is an area where much more needs to be done by the international community. As I said, cash couriers has become very prevalent in the use by terrorist organizations, and the enforcement of these kinds of declaration requirements is fairly new. So this is an area where we have a lot of intense focus right now. The third means that I mentioned of moving value was trade. And TFI has also been working with ICE to facilitate transparency across the global trade-based system by working on an international standard that's currently under discussion at the FATF. And trade transparency is also a good example of how the Treasury Asset Forfeiture Fund, which is the last component of TFI, provides support for innovative ideas in enforcement. TEOF, the Treasury Asset Forfeiture Fund, helped fund the development of ICE's Trade Transparency Unit. And this is really an innovative thing that they came up with. Working with a cooperative country, ICE will work to exchange trade data with another country. They'll take the U.S. data and the country from the other country's data and compare inbound reporting versus outbound reporting. When you combine that with FinCEN's data, with suspicious activity reports and cash transaction reports, et cetera, anomalies present themselves where what's reported going out doesn't match what is reported coming in, and you can focus your investigative resources on these kind of enriched targets. We think this holds great promise for bringing additional transparency to the trade arena, and we'll work with them to continue to expand their cooperative agreements with a variety of countries. On the targeted side, several times a week, TFI staff and leadership gather to discuss specific targets. An organization, an individual, or whatever. OIA, the Office of Intelligence Analysis, using all source intelligence, develops a picture of the target complemented by OFAC and FinCEN data and analysis. The group then reviews what courses of action are available to Treasury, administrative, regulatory, formal, or informal, that could disrupt or shut down the particular threat. And this process can unfold in a variety of ways. Perhaps the best known is designations. And obviously we've designated a number of individuals from a variety of different groups, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and others. Another tool is Section 311. This is a provision of the Patriot Act that authorizes the Secretary of the Treasury to find a foreign jurisdiction, a foreign financial institution, a class of transactions or a type of account to be a primary money laundering concern, and to subsequently impose either one or a combination of five special measures that then U.S. institutions must take in response to that. Now, Treasury used this tool in the terrorism context to alert the U.S. financial system to risks presented by the Commercial Bank of Syria and its subsidiary, the Syrian Lebanese Commercial Bank, for their role in facilitating terrorist support, including the laundering of proceeds from the illicit sale of Iraqi oil and the channeling of funds to terrorists and terrorist financiers. Sometimes the action that we will come up with will be informal, and Treasury has directly shared information with financial institutions concerning possible terrorist financing, particularly where there's a question about whether the institution is aware of what's going on. We feel that it's very important to share, where possible and appropriate, information with the private sector so that it can protect itself from activity that it wouldn't want to be associated with. Now, the U.S. is most effective in combating terrorist financing networks when it can act multilaterally. And TFI has worked diligently with our State Department colleagues to make effective the global terrorist financing sanctions regimes at the U.N., particularly resolutions, as I mentioned, 1267 and 1373. Now, many challenges remain in facilitating global compliance with these international obligations. To help address this, TFI, and particularly my office, has led a series of sanctions workshops that we have done through the FATF, through the Asia-Pacific Group, which is its largest regional body for Asia-Pacific, as well as with the European Union. The last several successive EU presidents have helped co-sponsor one of these workshops in a series. And they have walked through the various issues that present themselves in the application of targeted financial measures, legal authorities, targeting, due process concerns, etc. We think these efforts have led to a better understanding of the operational components of a sanctions regime at a national level. In anticipation of its upcoming renewal in June, we're also engaged with the State Department to further strengthen the 1267 sanctions regime at the UN, as well to streamline the execution of designations by the Al-Qaeda and Taliban Sanctions Committee. It's true that the private sector is really on the front lines of money laundering and terrorist financing, and therefore outreach and dialogue with them is extremely important. As you will see, it's truly a partnership, and we learn quite a lot from the private sector on ways to make compliance more effective and less burdensome. Many offices within TFI have forged close working relationships with the financial sector. One good illustration that my office has been involved in is what we call, it was the creation of the private sector dialogue. The PSD, as we call it, brings together U.S. banks with counterparts from key regions to discuss private sector implementation of sound AML-CFT controls. We have learned that the private sector often moves faster than governments. Often the private sector institutions are willing to go beyond what may be strictly required as the minimum AML-CFT requirements set by their home jurisdictions. Through the private sector dialogue, U.S. and regional banks can develop a clear picture, a shared picture of the risks that they face, and how to respond with appropriate AML-CFT measures. These shared understandings and the relationships lead not only to better AML-CFT implementation, but also foster deeper and more productive economic relationships between our regions. We currently have these dialogues underway with the Middle East and North Africa, as well as Latin America. Actually, Friday of this week, I'll be in Miami for the second event that we're doing with Latin America, looking for an event later this fall in Brazil. In the future, we're open to similar efforts with other regions. We have done three events now with the Middle East and North Africa, our last being in Dubai last December. Before I close, I'd like to make a few words, few remarks about Iran and update the Institute on some major developments since the Deputy Secretary was here. In May, the Deputy Secretary noted that the United States has employed a twofold sanctions strategy, utilizing domestic authorities and engaging in intense international outreach, highlighting deceptive conduct by Iran and particularly its state-owned banks. To date, in addition to a variety of domestic U.S. actions, multilateral efforts have yielded critical success in the adoption of two Chapter 7 U.N. Security Council resolutions, Resolutions 1737 and 47, imposing significant sanctions on Iran. These resolutions target Iran's nuclear and missile programs, and among other requirements, obligate states to freeze the assets of named entities and individuals associated with these programs. Perhaps most significantly on the finance side, the Security Council recognized the role that Iran's state-owned banks have played in facilitating Iran's proliferation activities, in particular with the designation of Bank SEPA. As the Deputy Secretary noted in his comments, domestic and international actions have been accompanied by Treasury's unprecedented outreach to the international private sector, meeting with more than 40 banks around the world to share information and discuss the risks of doing business with Iran. Since May, there have been some significant developments both on the domestic and international fronts. In October, the FATF issued a public statement confirming the extraordinary systemic risks that Iran poses to the global financial system. FATF also issued guidance to assist countries in implementing the financial provisions of the UN resolutions on Iran. That guidance identified customers and transactions associated with Iran as representing a significant risk of involvement in proliferation finance. Consistent with the FATF statement, jurisdictions all over the world have begun issuing warnings to their financial institutions of these risks. Additionally, on October 25th, the Treasury and State Departments took a series of coordinated actions aimed at key instrumentalities of the regime's proliferation and terror support activities. Under Executive Order 13382, our Proliferation Authority, the State Department designated two key Iranian entities of proliferation concern, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, and the Ministry of Defense for Armed Forces Logistics. That same day, Treasury designated, for proliferation activities under the same executive order, Iran's state-owned banks Meli and Malat. In addition, nine IRGC-affiliated entities and a number of individuals associated with the IRGC and Iran's Aerospace Industries Organization. Treasury also designated, under its terrorism authority, the IRGC Quds Force and Iran's state-owned bank, Bank Sadarat, as a terrorist financier. We continue to see the effects that these efforts have had. Iran and its state-owned banks, in particular, are finding themselves increasingly isolated. Many financial institutions around the world have made the decision that doing business with Iran is not worth the heightened risk of unwittingly being implicated in its nuclear or missile efforts and its support for terrorism. We will continue to work with our international partners, both in the public and private sectors, to implement the UN Security Council resolutions, pursue additional multilateral steps, share information, and protect the international financial system from deceptive conduct and abuse. Discussions are also underway in the Security Council about another resolution, and we look forward to swift action on this next important step. In conclusion, I'd just say that our financial enforcement efforts have come a long way from the sanctions measures that have been applied to threats in the past. As demonstrated by our recent experience in the context of Iran, we have learned that the most effective measures are carefully targeted at illicit conduct, are multilateral in scope, and are combined with private sector and foreign government outreach. These principles hold true with respect to all forms of illicit financing, be they terrorism, proliferation, narcotics, or other criminal conduct. While in the past our broad-based country sanctions have been criticized by some as an inappropriate extension of U.S. law, these new targeted efforts can have the effect of engaging our allies. Sanctions have the most comprehensive impact when applied cooperatively and collectively. We are working hard internationally with governments and the private sector to build the consensus and the capacity to do just that. I thank you for this time with you, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.